For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're in this chapter where he basically goes right through the entire Old Testament from page one to page whatever. And tonight we got up last time as far as Moses and into his life. Tonight we're going to finish the rest of the Old Testament. He kind of hits the fast forward button right here and starts moving through the last part of it pretty quick. But we'll just pick out a few cases because, you know, his point is that the content of people's faith at different periods and situations and the nature of the situations they're in change, but that certain basic principles of faith are pretty much the same age to age and still the same today. So we can learn from these stories. The first one that he brings up after Moses, in verse 30, he says, "By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. Okay, this is one of those cities they were so scared of. If you were with us back in chapter 3, we talked at Kadesh Barnea, they wouldn't go in because they said these cities are fortified up to heaven. We have no idea how to breach, you know, these walls. And this would have been one of the bigger cities that they faced. We have the story starting earlier. 40 years now have passed since that point where they turned away and just said, we can't do this. And during that whole time, God's been at work showing them, you know, things about himself. And this is a whole new generation now that have come in. The first thing they had to do was cross the Jordan River, which is kind of an interesting case regarding faith. They're coming in this time instead of from the south like before. They're coming in from the east to the west, and they had to cross over the Jordan River, and right by near the Dead Sea there you see the city of Jericho. Crossing the Jordan River, we read it was spring. The river was in a flooded stage. They couldn't get across it. They needed a miracle. They needed God to stop the water up in the river. The instructions for crossing the river in chapter 3 of Joshua. God says, it shall come about when the soles of the feet of the priests who carry the ark of the Lord of all the earth rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan will be cut off and the waters which are flowing down from above. Hello. The thing to notice here, the soles of the feet of the priests. So they're going to send the priests out carrying the ark on these poles that carry the ark. And everyone's going to follow after them. And he's very specific that the soles of the feet have to rest in the water. Isn't that kind of funny? You would think, well, we'll come up to the river, you know, and then we're standing here. Okay, God, we're ready for you to act now. Not good enough. You have to step into the water. This is called a step of faith. Okay? Think how much more stupid you're going to look standing in the water with this ark and nothing's happening. I mean, at least if you're on the edge, you could be like, maybe it was tomorrow, something like that. But you're going to walk out into the water, even though so apparently nothing's happening. You know, you're walking into water that's surging, and there's no sign that God's going to do anything. It would be very difficult to do, extremely difficult to do this. But I think it's typical. I've seen this. I think it's a principle. And a lot of times you'll see believers, God is on their case. God wants them to make a move in their lives. And in principle, they're willing to do it. But they'll come right up to the edge of it and say, okay, God, because they want to see God make his move before I make my move. And the problem then is that we're putting our trust in the seen, not in the unseen. To put your feet into the water, to get wet feet, there's no sign, there's nothing visible here that shows that God's about to do anything. And so it's a principle of faith that he will often challenge us. I've talked to many people, even when it comes to receiving God in the first place, who have been like, you know, well, I just don't quite feel it yet. I think it's true, but I'm not quite feeling it. You know, you may never feel it. I don't think they felt like, let's just walk into this water. It's not a feeling, okay? It's an action. And God will call on us for that as kind of a tangible way to demonstrate, I'm ready to trust you now. Well, the step of faith. So, they crossed over, and now they come up to this city of Jericho. People in the city of Jericho didn't want to leave. That was one option. According to the book of Deuteronomy, people could leave, step aside, find a different place. God had said this land's going to be given to the children of Israel, and they didn't want to do that. Another option they had, they could have joined Israel, and it was okay if they wanted to become part of what God was doing through the Jewish people. They could do that. They didn't want to do that. They wanted to fight. And so they're going to get fought with. Okay, so now we come up. Here's this city. Ancient cities tend to be on hills because they call them tells, as there would be destruction layers. They were just they were constantly warring with each other, so that as buildings would burn and so forth, they would just knock them down, pack them in, and then just build the next layer on top of that. So there's these layers as you go down through these ancient tells. This is one of the most ancient tells in the world. It's still there today. As you go up, though, it also gets a little narrower each time, obviously, because you're not just going to have completely vertical layers there. So you're already, the city itself is already on a little tell, a hill, which these can go 30, 50, 60 feet tall. And then they built a wall on top of that, which could go another 20, 30 feet tall. And so you had an uphill struggle to get at this city. And we talked before about this was not a trained military force. They didn't have any experience or knowledge on what to do in a situation like this. Maybe build a ramp. That's what some people would do. They'd build a huge ramp. Of course, you had to keep your shields and protect up there because they're bombarding you the whole time you're trying to build this ramp up to the wall. It's not too easy. You could try to dig a tunnel under it, and then you undermine the wall and get part of it to collapse, and that makes it for an opening. Of course, they can see what you're doing. They've got an excellent vantage point, so they countermine and can make your tunnel collapse on you instead of their wall on them. People were used to these tactics. You could always try to build a rolling tower that has a lot of animal hides on it, and then when it gets close enough, a drawbridge goes down to the wall, and you run your warriors out on it. Not easy to build. You need to have decent ground, too. This area's got a lot of wadis and a lot of erosion. It needs to be kind of flat, and you need a lot of lumber, which there is no lumber around here. This is a desert area. This would be a rough job here, too. Not easy. Sometimes you just get like a whole bunch of ladders made and just get all these guys to carry ladders and go running up, and there are so many ladders being put up that and people running up them, it would just overwhelm the defenses, and you could get into the city that way. None of these tactics were used. The tactics are spelled out very carefully for us in Joshua 6. We read that Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went in, no one out. And the Lord came to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and its valiant warriors." So the first thing we notice is that this is not going to be Joshua's idea, okay? It wasn't for them to decide, hey, let's go take a city or anything like that. God was directing this entire thing. He had made it clear back in Deuteronomy chapter 8, "I've had it with these guys and they're coming under my judgment. And it's not because of you. You have nothing to do with it." He says, "I would be doing this even if you weren't there." Well, here's how you're going to do it. He says, you're going to march around the city. All the men of war circling the city once. And then you're going to do that for 6 more days. Every day you're going to walk around the city. All the men of war. This is probably a force of, most people estimate, probably 40,000 men. So this is not just a little ceremonial troop honor guard walking around. This is an immense line. These cities were not like our cities. It wouldn't be the size of Columbus or anything like that. I've actually seen this tell. It's probably not even a quarter mile across in diameter, but very tightly packed with people. They would have 10 people living in a one-room place, so you'd have a lot of people in there, but very tight. And so walking around it, though, you also had to stay out of arrow range, so you couldn't walk right next to it. So you had a sizable walk to get around this thing, probably 3 or 4 miles minimum, and you're doing it with 40,000 men, and you're doing it day after day. 6 days in a row. 7 priests are going to carry the 7 trumpet of the ram horns in front of the ark. So we're going to have the ark going around. Priests with horns, and then the 40,000 men. On the 7th day, you're going to march around the city 7 times. And then the priests are going to blow those trumpets. Oh my God. So this entire plan, this strategy, is totally counterintuitive. This is the most insane plan you could ever come up with. Let's march around the city 13 different times, and then we'll blow our horns. And, you know, you're out there. This is over 1,000 feet below sea level. It's the lowest spot in the world, the Dead Sea. It's hot all year. It's hot down there. Sunny. Marching along, it gets even worse. Obviously, God is dictating this plan. This is nothing that they're reasoning out whatsoever. We read in verse 5, it shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people are going to shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And then the people can go up, every man straight ahead, and take over the city. One more point. Joshua commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout or let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed from your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. This is the worst part in my mind. Imagine yourself out there trudging along. You've got your armor on, which was, you know, either heavy leather or metal. Your weapons. You don't have your good Nikes on or anything. These guys... You're trudging along day after day. You can imagine the people up on the wall. You know? Well, come on! What's wrong with you guys? Oh, you're going to blow horns at us now. Whoa. You know? We got something for you. What are you going to... You're going to check it out again. Didn't get a good look last time, huh? And, you know, you're there marching along, and you're just looking at each other, looking at the situation, not allowed to say a word. You know, every person is just inside of their own head out here, struggling with unbelief. I can't believe we're doing this again. And then, on that 7th day, you're gonna march 7 times around that city. If the march was as low as 3 or 4 miles, you're still talking about the maximum amount. I was just reading that Stonewall Jackson's Confederate soldiers were considered the best marchers of any army in the Civil War. And on one forced march, they covered 30 miles in a day. That's like the most that's possible. These guys are approaching that. They're up on that level. And then... they're going to have to fight a battle after that. Doesn't sound too smart. Nothing about this sounds too smart. And I just can't imagine just marching like that and not get to, at least if you could talk to people about it and say, you know, dude, what do you think? No, absolute silence. This was really a kind of a strict test that they were being put under. And they did it, you know. I mean, one reason for keeping marching is the alternative would be to run up that hill after those guys with all those rocks and spears and stuff up there. Maybe we should just keep marching. I could see that. Well, We see that God, what God made them do, they were taking action, but yet there was inaction. The action they were being taken, called on to take, didn't directly relate in any cause and effect way with what they were hoping to achieve. And yet it was important, and especially that again and again going around with nothing happening. It's just the same thing. Yes, there is a principle here, and God will actually call on his people to do this. To walk. Just keep walking. And you say, wait, nothing's happening. I'm not accomplishing anything. Just walk. And it's a form, it's similar to that other idea we talked about earlier where he makes a promise and makes people wait. Here is kind of even a higher level where he makes calls on people to act. Well, eventually they suffered. No question about that. Even up to the final time. Here we are. We've been around this thing 7 times today. My feet are killing me. And, you know, the sun is setting. And still up to that very moment, there was no sign whatsoever that anything was going to happen. And then we read, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, they finally blew those horns. Everyone shouted with a great shout. The walls fell down. And so the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. The fall of Jericho. So this is why he says in Hebrews, back in Hebrews 11, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. Yeah, that is a high watermark of faith, I would say. I don't think Israel probably ever reached this level of faith again in their whole subsequent history. This is a truly amazing event. By faith, Rahab, the harlot, did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she welcomed. Rahab lived in Jericho. She was a Jericho prostitute. And she had saved the lives of some of the spies that had come to spy out the land earlier. She knew and acknowledged the reality of God. And we read about it in Joshua 2, verse 9 through 11. She says, I know that Yahweh has given you guys this land. Yahweh, your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. I know that Yahweh has given you the land, for we heard that the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. And when we heard it, our hearts melted and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For Yahweh, your God, he is God in heaven and earth, heaven above and earth beneath. They knew all about Egypt. Egypt was the predominant power in this part of the world. This entire area of Canaan was under a suzerain arrangement where Egypt was their overlord nation. This event of the Egyptian army getting blown away, the one we studied last week, they had heard about it. That word got out. This information that she's giving out here was available to everybody. Everyone knew about it. And in her case, she connected the logical dots and was like, I don't want to fight with you guys. I want to be on your side. And so they said, when we come, you hang a red thing out the window and you'll be rescued and your family too. Rahab, the prostitute, looking at the obvious and believing it. And what more shall we say? He says, for time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. And so he starts rattling off these, some of them are judges, kings, prophets. Definitely no perfection in this list whatsoever. These are not perfect people, far from it. Gideon was a sissy. Barak was even worse. He refused to go to take on the Midianites unless a woman, Deborah, would lead the way. Samson was a hound dog, couldn't keep his hands off the Philistine women. David, good Lord, a hound dog and a murderer, and so on it went. Calvin says about this passage, truly, I think, in every saint there's something reprehensible. Nevertheless, although faith may be imperfect and incomplete, it does not cease to be approved by God. A pretty important point. God doesn't hold out for perfection here. He's calling on us for faith. warts and all, you know, we come as we are. We come as messed up as we happen to be. And as long as we're willing to keep coming back and placing that faith, we get the acceptance he talks about. He says these people by faith conquered kingdoms. That was definitely the case with David, with Joshua that are mentioned here. Some of them performed acts of righteousness. Or we could translate dikaios can mean righteousness or justice. And I think in the context, maybe the judges, he's referring to the judges rendering justice during that period. Some of them obtained promises. That probably refers to the prophets, right? They're the ones that got all of the promises that we read when we talk about this amazing prophetic, you know, sequence of promises about how God's going to send the chosen one someday who's going to be the rescuer of humanity. These were the prophets that got these promises and then wrote them down, copied them, disseminated them so that we had many copies from many different places, even different countries. So there can be no question at all that the promises are authentic and that they long predate the things that they promise. That was a crucial part of setting up what God was doing here. This plan that he is working had to have a written prophetic record, widely copied, widely disseminated, widely known, and much more ancient than the things predicted, so that there was only one explanation when all of these promises came true, that it was God at work. Shut the mouths of lions. That's probably talking about Daniel, one of the prophets, right? Threw him in the lion's den. Quenched the power of fire. That's probably from Daniel also. It's probably talking about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Three guys that were taken prisoner along with Daniel, taken to the greatest empire in the world at that time, which was the Neo-Babylonian Empire. This is 1,000 years after Moses. These guys, younger than your age, okay, taken there when they are old enough to speak fluent Hebrew, so 12, 14, and yet young enough to be completely reprogrammed in their loyalty to become Babylonians. The Babylonians needed kids like this who could be turned into translators and viceroys who would be able to, you know, to rule these conquered areas and could speak their language, but whose loyalty had switched now and they were loyal to Babylon. They put him in a school to reprogram their mind, to completely press them into the mold of the kind of guys they were going to be. You see this in their names. It's kind of interesting. Daniel, his name means God is judge. They rename him Belshazzar. Baal protects his life. Hananiah was his buddy. His name means Jehovah is gracious. They renamed him Shadrach, command of Aku, a moon deity. Mishael's name means who is what God is. They renamed him Meshach, who is what Aku is. And then Azariah, his name means the Lord helps. And so they renamed him Abednego, servant of Nabu. And so starting, you know, with their names and their identity, they're going to crush the Yahwism, the all memory of faithfulness to the God of their fathers and the God of the Bible. And they're going to become nice, compliant polytheists now. They put him in this school. They have no mothers, no fathers there. They have no relatives there, no social support. So they're all on their own, and they're going to spend years training them, it says, in all the wisdom of the Chaldeans. They're basically studying occult religion the whole time. And, you know, it comes to a head in this story that's being referred to here. Oops. Everyone lined up, and the emperor is like, okay, when we blow the horns and so forth, everybody's going to bow down and worship a statue of me out here. And so they have like thousands of people gathered. They blow the horns. Everybody bows down. Here's three guys still standing up. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I guess Daniel was out in some province by this time. He obviously was not there when this happened. And they're like, we'll throw you into a fire for this. And they're like, whatever. And he says, what God can save you if we throw you into a fiery furnace? And I'm like, our God could do that. But even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down. And so I think both things were important. Yes, God could actually save us. He's got that kind of power. But whether he does or doesn't, you know, we're not, our actions aren't contingent on that. They flipped him in there and saw someone else in there with him, a fourth person. They're like, whoa, we threw three guys, there's four. When they came out, the only thing that had been burned was the ropes that they tied him with. Their clothes weren't burned. They said they didn't even smell like soot. Completely protected in the midst of that. Some of them escaped the edge of the sword. You know, this would certainly be true with Elijah, with Elisha, Jeremiah, were all threatened with the sword and managed to escape it. Some from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. A perfect description of Gideon. Here's another principle. While we're noticing key principles of faith, let's think this for a second about Gideon. Here was a guy, he was not a fighter, he was kind of a passive guy. He says, I can't do this. And the Lord had called him. He says, go deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. This was an invading army that had taken over part of the country there. Have I not sent you? Gideon says, oh Lord, wait, how can I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh, and I'm the youngest guy in my father's house. I've got nothing to offer here. The Lord said, surely I'll be with you. I think that makes a difference. Yes, it does. Well, he's like, I'm not sure I can believe what you're saying. So he goes through this whole thing of fleecing. He puts out some wool. And he's like, now in the morning, if I get up and there's dew on the wool, but none on the grass, then that means yes. And so he comes up and sure enough, there's dew on the wool and none on the grass. He's like, and that means, was it dew on the wool? Or was it dew on, I think I meant to say dew on the grass, but not on the wool. Yeah, that means yes. And he came out the next day and that had happened too. So he's, okay, I guess I'm going to have to do this. He goes out and he puts out a message and he finally sends out runners to different tribes. They gather an army together, 32,000 men strong. They were still outnumbered by the Midianites. So this is a big army they're going up against. Check out what God says to him. Chapter 7, verse 2, the Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands. Because Israel would become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me. Here again then, so this is kind of similar. Do you see the similarity between what's happening here and what happened at Jericho? God is pretty zealous. He's willing to help. He's willing to act. But he does not want us taking credit for what he did. And the fact is, that's exactly what we would do if we get half the chance. And so he goes to an amazing extreme here to make sure that nobody is confused about who did this. He takes them down. He says, first calls out to his army. He says, anybody out here that's scared, if you feel like you're trembling, not sure you want to do this, go home. 22,000 out of his 32,000 are like, actually, I'm a little nervous. I think I'll just head on out of here. Now he's just lost two-thirds of his force, more than two-thirds. There's only 10,000 left. He's up against 80 or 90,000 Midianites. Well, the Lord's not done. He says, yeah, there's still too many. I can't work with that. He says, take them down to the stream, okay? And I'm put to test before you there. And it will be that he of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, he can go with you, but everyone of whom I say, this one shall not go with you, he's not going. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said, okay, now separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue. So if you bent down to the water and picked it up, out, gone. Everybody who kneels down and laps the water, all of them go. And so the lappers and the kneelers turn out to be all but 300 guys who, like, don't kneel and just pick up water and drink it that way. And God's like, that'll do, 300. So they're going to take 300 guys, and they're going to go down to this Midianite army. He says, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped, and I'll give the Midianites into your hands. Now, the Midianites and their allies, the Amalekites, were there too, lying in this valley as numerous as locusts. Their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Great vision. Here, sunsets, getting dark, campfires all over you. This entire valley just blanketed with enemy soldiers that are here to plunder and loot your country. You got 300 dudes. Okay. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came out to the outskirts of the camp, the beginning of the middle of the watch, when they had just posted the watch. Okay, and they gave each man three things: a trumpet, a clay pot, and a torch. They spread them out, the first watch, so it's dark, completely dark now. They spread out an arc around this camp. And when they posted it, they blew the trumpets, smashed the pitchers that were in their hands, causing the torches to come to appear. So imagine yourself in the Midianite camp. Usually, they used trumpets in ancient battle, but usually it would be like an entire, like, brigade or whatever, a regiment of soldiers would have one guy with a horn to signal them where to go. Same with the torches. You had torches that you would follow, but it wasn't everyone carrying a torch. It was just the leaders. The leader would carry a torch, and you were supposed to follow that at night. They've got 300 guys out here. All of them have horns. All of them have torches. And then they do this thing where they break these clay. So imagine what that would sound like all the way around you. Clickling, rattling noise. It probably sounded like, people getting their swords out and getting, armor clicking, clacking. And then all of a sudden, there's 300 horns go off. There's torches all the way around you. It looks like there's an incredible force out here. They just lost it. They're all drunk, too. And, they're just like, they just start to run. And it says that they start fighting with each other along the way. They didn't know what was going on. And so they were completely routed. Very interesting story. But I love that fact that God refused to go ahead on this. It would have been a lot easier with 32,000, I think. Cut them down to 300 dudes, and the Midianites flee and fight each other in the darkness. Yeah. Wow. 35. Women receive back their dead by resurrection. That sounds like that lady up in the Phoenicia, in Zarephath, in the city of Zarephath. She got her son back when Elijah prayed over him, and he came back from the dead. Some were tortured, not accepting their release. Could be Jeremiah. He was thrown in that cistern, starved, cut off of water. Others experienced mockings and scourgings. Yes, also chains and imprisonment. This could include even the early Christians. Some of these people had seen this happen with people right there in their own city. Think of Peter and John publicly beaten and also chained and imprisoned, and God had to get them out. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. Well, they had seen Stephen stoned right there. He was stoned to death right in Jerusalem. Sawn in two, apparently referring to Isaiah. This was a story that was current. We're not sure where it came from, but the intertestamental literature says that they put Isaiah in a hollow log And then I saw the logging too. Rough way to go. I don't think I could get into that. Put to death with the sword. They had seen James Zebedee killed. They took him out and publicly ran him through in front of the whole crowd, cheered. John the Baptist had had his head cut off within their lifetime. And this kind of stuff, going around in sheepskins, goatskins, destitute, afflicted. Boy, career path not working out too well. Maybe should have thought about graduate school. And, you know, it is madness. When we read about the life of faith, it can include things like this. Trial, suffering. There's a sacrifice for the people of God to follow him. And to people that don't know God, this is just sheer insanity. What's wrong with you? You're an idiot. Until we get that unseen part comes into focus and becomes the seen. Men of whom the world was not worthy. One commentator says, to all outward appearances, these people of faith were insignificant and unimportant. But the true situation was very different. They were worth more than the world, though they had lacked everything. Jesus was one of these, you know. He said, even foxes have holes to live in. A son of man has no place to lay his head. Paul was too. Poorly clothed, he says. Naked. Often hungry. All these, he says, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they could not be made perfect. Or, I think, teleos here should be translated, not perfect, but complete. And which it also means can be translated either way. What are we saying? Here's the punchline of the whole chapter, okay? These people went through all these things that they went through. Victories were won. Yes, promises were fulfilled, but not the promise, not the big promise. For that, it couldn't happen to them. It couldn't happen until us. And of course, he's referring to the people in his own day who had witnessed with their own eyes the culmination of this plan that God's been working on for thousands of years. It's all part of a stream of a plan of God. And they didn't receive the promise, the clincher for the whole plan, which was the coming of Jesus Christ. When God basically came and made humanity's problem his problem, went to the cross and underwent the judgment for his own judgment for all human sin. That was the big promise. And that, of course, threw wide open the door for a new level of relationship in faith with God that's unlike anything that had come before, where people could actually have the Spirit of God come and live within them, to know God at that intimate level. And the plan's still not over. It's still not done. You know, these people that he's writing to are losing it. They're fading. And they need to be reminded, dudes, all of these heroes that you've grown up admiring, now it's your turn. Don't fade out. Don't lose it, because this story is not over. And in that connection, then we also come into direct contact with it ourselves. Yeah. We've finished this massive chapter 11 of Hebrews and this survey of the entire Old Testament. You see that these giants of faith did great things. They basically accomplished the mission that God gave them. They did lay that ground that needed to be laid so that people could actually know that the Messiah was real and that this was not some kind of a faker coming in. They accomplished that. God gave his approval of them one by one as we study the Old Testament. These are the people held up to us. These are the people that God says, this is where it's at. Here's how you live for me. Here's what real faith means. And yet, what did it lead to? We come up to the end of the Old Testament. You know, they get thrown out of the country for a period of time to Babylon when that Shadrach, Meshach business happened. And they get back and they rebuild the city. And like they're back in the land. And then what? It just ends hanging in the middle of the air. It's like, this seems like it's all been building towards something, but what? And it just stops. And that's because the Old Testament is such an obviously unfinished book. The finish is right there when the shocker of all times happened and we realize where this is all headed. I don't know that these guys actually even realized at all exactly how this was going to be worked out. But now, once the New Testament came, once Jesus came, people realized, so this is it. This is what this has all been about all these years. So our readers, they see that now, although they've been wavering. We see it in our day because the story's still not over. As we've discussed in previous weeks, God's plan isn't done yet. Jesus said, I'm going to come back. And you got between now and then, says the reason he's putting off his return is that he is merciful and doesn't want to see anyone perish. He wants to see many all come to faith and no one perish. And so there's more and more chance for more and more people to come under the forgiveness of God. And that's what's happening in our own day. And we get to take a part in it. And there you have the message of Hebrews 11. Yes, Lord. So glad that you haven't called on me to get sawn in half. I hate thinking about that. And yet, it's awesome that guys like, if that was Isaiah, I hate that, but yet he did it. And I guess he's over it now. But, you know, we can look and learn vicariously. We can look at examples like this and realize I don't need to go through everything they did. I can learn from their example, vicarious learning. Yeah, there are models. And we'll have our own trials that are of the sort that you feel we need. And we can trust you for that too, God. And we pray for an awesome and safe week down at the beach this week. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.